Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix? I feel like I'm still recovering from the drunken binge fest that was the trade deadline. Have you recovered? I feel like I'm still dizzy from it all.
I mean, I didn't have much to recover from. Like you're working a lot during that, but I mean, I was, you know. The people I respect in these moments are Woj, Shams, the two guys that are, you know, just going, or reporting on Kevin Durant at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, the day before the trade deadline. That's wacky. But it definitely was interesting. I encourage people to go listen to the two-part megapod we did with Rohan Nadkarni and Chris Herring. One of those episodes is on our podcast feed. The other one is on the Open Floor feed. We got into all the trade deadline machinations. One deal we didn't get to touch on, Howard, because it did have a bit of a wrinkle over the weekend. That was the four-team deal that involved Gary Payton II going from Portland to Golden State. Now, this was a multi-team deal. Payton went from Portland to Golden State. Golden State sent James Wiseman out to Detroit. But the key player in all this was Gary Payton, who Golden State really wanted because they knew that they needed something, some kind of veteran help off their bench in order to, you know, really make a run in this postseason if they're going to do it at all. So they get Gary Payton, and then we find out in the immediate aftermath that Payton could have an abdominal issue that the Warriors at least believe that Golden State was, or that Portland was hiding. There were reports about Tordal that Payton may have been taking. First it was shots, now it was oral. Oral Tordal is, that's like a powerful Tylenol. Like that's much better than injections, so that needed to be clarified for sure. But it's this trade is, as we record this, going to go through. Gary Payton will be a Warrior. I don't know how long he's going to have to be out for, but it definitely bothered people in Golden State. And Howard, talking to a few people around the league, it bothered them too. Like, there's kind of an honor code here that if you have a guy and he's dealing with an injury, you fully disclose that injury before you agree to trade him. And Golden State, at least, did not believe they had all the information regarding Gary Payton's injury. So what was your kind of read on, you know, how this all kind of blew up a little over the weekend?
I mean, first things first, it's not just a matter of like decorum or courtesy. The NBA has rules. about injury disclosure when you're making trades. And there's a certain amount of transparency that is required. And it certainly seems like, at least from the Warrior side of this, they believe that the Blazers were not transparent. You and I don't have all the information that will be necessary to determine that. The NBA will have all that information, however. And so at some point, I'm sure we will hear a result of that. There will be an investigation. The NBA will collect all the information that they can get, including a lot of stuff that the public can't be privy to because of HIPAA laws, medical privacy laws. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into this, from Gary Payton's side of it, from the Blazers' side, from the Warriors' side. Eventually, we'll know. And if the Blazers did, in fact, withhold critical information that compromised the Warriors' position in this trade, which they've since accepted the trade. We'll get into that in a second. But, you know, you do have to have these checks and balances and some accountability. And so if the league determines the Blazers withheld anything that they shouldn't have, they could dock them picks. They could fine them. There are mechanisms to deal with it. Until then, I feel like you and I and the public don't know enough to know exactly what happened here. Other than, I will say this, the Warriors aren't just randomly trying to cast aspersions. That's silly. I've seen some people kind of intimate that, like, why? Why would they do that? They wanted Gary Payton II. They wanted him because they know he's really a very valuable role player and defender, and a guy who was a critical piece of their championship run last spring. They're obviously disappointed that he's not fully healthy. They're not making this up out of thin air. So I don't understand some of the, like, pushback from the Portland side of, like, well, you know, the Warriors are somehow the ones creating some kind of, like, manufactured controversy. Like, if he's healthy, they would just say he's healthy and play him. They want to play him, clearly. That's why they acquired him. I still believe they made the right deal in terms of, if not the trade itself, they really had no choice at the end, right? You're not going to undo a four-team trade. That's after the trade deadline. Now you have no options. Now Wiseman comes back, and there's a whole awkward situation there, and Sadiq Bey goes back to Detroit, and the Hawks lose. Everybody loses out. It's a disaster. And on top of that, you know, they got Payton for the present, they hoped, and maybe they'll get him this season. But for the future also, he's under contract for at least one more year, then a player option. He's at a good number. He could be really helpful for their team regardless. So it makes sense to stick with it. But I will say this. If this all happened 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks before the trade deadline, and then you have this kind of medical hitch come up, you might be rescinding the trade and sending Wiseman somewhere else for somebody else, or maybe you're just keeping Sadiq Bey instead of redirecting him in a four-team deal. So it does materially hurt the Warriors' ability to contend this season, potentially, if Payton doesn't get healthy in time for the playoffs.
So the Blazers were getting five second round picks in that trade, which was like, you know, Christmas at Mike Schmidt's house, you know, for all the second round picks that he was getting there. I have a feeling, and it's more educated guessing right now, but I have a feeling that they'll lose some of those picks, that whatever the end result of the trade was, Golden State will get a couple of them back because of all this. That seems like a, you know, reasonable solution if it turns out that Portland was not transparent in disclosing this injury. I heard a lot of people suggest that, all right, well, you know, all these wings now on the market, Danny Green, Terrence Ross, a bunch of guys that were getting bought out. Maybe the Warriors would want to void that deal so they could keep Wiseman around and go out and get someone comparable to Gary Payton. That was never, my understanding is that was never really realistic for Golden State. Number one, part of the reason they like Gary Payton is that he played there last year. So it should be a pretty seamless transition back into this Warriors system. Number two, they moved off Wiseman for a reason. Like, Wiseman has a player or team option for next year at $12 million. That may not seem like a lot, at least for an NBA team, but Golden State's in the position where, like, every dollar they spend, it costs them like 20 in the luxury tax. It's a massive payment that's coming. So by moving off this Wiseman contract, they save themselves a bundle of money in terms of long-term deals. So the idea of bringing Wiseman back and going out and doing what it took to bring in Terrence Ross or Danny Green or whoever might be out there to play a backup role, that was this never ultimately realistic. So look, I'm curious to see how injured Payton is. Look, he had abdominal surgery last summer. He missed the first 35 games of this year. He's played since early January. He just played 22 minutes against Golden State the other night. But you know, if the Warriors are that concerned that he may miss some time, you know, that may be certainly a factor for the rest of the regular season and depending on how he bounces back in the playoffs. But I'm with you. I don't think that this was always kind of what the end result was going to be, and the Warriors will kick the can down the road. The NBA will deal with this at some point. They'll do a more thorough investigation, but because, you know, time is of the essence, this was really all that they were ultimately going to do.
Yeah, so. And I will just say, again, the thing we'll never know is what would have happened if this trade had been long before the trade deadline, if they had actual time to clean up the mess, where it's like, if it were that concerning, you know, the idea that they let the trade go through, people should not interpret that as the Warriors are fine with it or it's some concession. They clearly decided it's too much trouble to undo the trade at this stage. They can't retrade Wiseman now because the trade deadline has passed. Like, they're making the best of a bad situation and making sure that the league understands that there's a problem here as they see it. So we'll never know, you know, what would have happened if this had happened a couple weeks ago and they had had time to rescind the trade and do something else. I have to believe, given how strongly the Warriors are making this into a case, they would have made a different trade. Like, that's the bottom line. And so this does, it hurts them a little bit. While we've been talking, a couple tweets out of Warriors availabilities today. CJ Holmes from the San Francisco Chronicle says Bob Myers notes that there are things he can't disclose because of legal reasons, but also that Gary Payton's going to be reevaluated in a month, and the hope is to have him back for the playoffs. So, you know, this may pan out for them okay if Payton can make the postseason, or at least if the Warriors can last long enough in the postseason for him to get back.
Blazers are really an interesting team, aren't they? Like, I think we talked about them a little bit on the pod last week, but like, that franchise just feels ambitionless, you know? Like,
the Blazers?
I just feel. Like, it's like their main objective is to be as competitive as possible with Damian Lillard in uniform, but not really have a pathway to winning a championship. Like, they're bad this year, and you can't point to injury issues. Like, Lillard has been largely healthy. Jeremy Grant has been healthy. Like, I think their top six or seven guys have played somewhere in the neighborhood of 40-plus games. You know, like, this is not a situation where Portland can point to one guy being out, and that's why they're struggling. And, you know, I don't see how this is, and I don't want to make this all a conversation about Damian Lillard and his future, because Dame doesn't complain about this stuff. Like, he signed his contract extension, and every time somebody asks him about his future in Portland, he's some version of 10 toes in with the Blazers. But I mean, like, is there a more ambitionless franchise in the NBA?
Yeah,
right
the
now?
Wizards.
Like, well, no, but like the Wizards, like, I think they're crazy. Like, I think their plan is stupid, right? Like, I don't believe that some combination of Bradley Beal, Kyle Kuzma, and Kristaps Porzingis is going to win you anything, right? Like, but no. I mean, like, Tommy Shepard in that front office, for whatever reason, like, that's at least a modicum of ambition. Like, the Blazers, they go got Jeremy Grant, and he's a good player, but, I mean, he's extension eligible, right? Or he's going to be a free agent, and he didn't sign an extension yet, so there's a chance you could lose him for nothing. I don't know what the game plan in Portland is, except to, you know, keep Damian Lillard in that uniform, keep him happy playing in that uniform, and then, you know, build a statue for him, you know, 10 years from now after his career is retired. So, I don't want to make this a big Blazers Lillard referendum, because we do this all the time. Like, will Lillard get traded? Well, he doesn't want to be, at least he's not saying so. And the Blazers have shown no inclination of doing so. But I see no pathway to relevancy with that team.
And to your point, about, you know, them being sort of on the treadmill of mediocrity, which is funny because I believe that phrase was coined by Kevin Pritchard, who's now obviously executive with the Pacers, but he was with the Blazers years and years ago when I think he coined the term treadmill of mediocrity while he was, I think, still with the Blazers, not referring to himself or his own franchise at the time, by the way. But they're on the treadmill. The mere fact of trading Josh Hart, who was a very good role player for them, traded him to the Knicks, and on the same day acquiring Matisse Thybulle. Like, okay, fine. You offloaded one defender and you got another defender. And like, what did that series of transactions, where did it get them? What did it move the ball forward at all? Does it chart a better course in any, on any level? I don't, Like, it's fine. Thibault's fine. Josh Hart's really good. I don't know exactly what the mission was there that they were trying to accomplish. There are a handful of franchises every year and some in perennial fashion where you look at them and go, I just don't know what you're doing. And Washington has always been there. Orlando was there for years. They finally seem to have caught some traction by, you know, just being in the lottery every year. And eventually you get some good players.
Yeah, but that's a strategy. Like, one thing I think about with Portland is, like, you know, before Danny Ainge took that job in Utah, he was rumored to be in the mix for the head job in Portland. And if Danny Ainge had taken over that team, Damian Lillard would be a Laker or a Warrior or something other than a Portland Trailblazer, because he wouldn't have kept that group together and just kind of treaded water as long as they have. I respect keeping your star in uniform, but if you're a fan of the team, like, what are you supporting at this point? Like, what is the end game here? I just don't see it. I don't see what the end game is here. And it's kind of maddening. Because I really do believe that you either have to be on a path to being really good or on a path to being really bad. And the Blazers are on neither.
No, that's the treadmill of mediocrity. And this is a new front office, right? This is Joe Cronin's first full season in charge. And, you know, if there was a sense that they had gotten stale and directionless under Neil O'Shea before, Neil O'Shea never wanted to break up the Lillard-McCollum backcourt. Credit to Joe Cronin for being the one to decide to do that, and I thought he made a decent deal. There was a lot that they were just kind of like stuck in place because O'Shea was really confident in his own path and the guys that he had gotten, and he didn't want to break it up, and he didn't want to change course. So I think Joe Cronin initially makes some moves to try to kind of establish a different direction here, or at least course correct while still keeping Dame Lillard. But yeah, right now, this is starting to feel like a more of the same. And yeah, again, if you're a Blazers fan, what is it you're rooting for? Is there a path here to get a second star next to Dame ever? Because if there's not, then what are you holding on to? And, you know, that, you know, in that regard, it feels like same as it ever was, you know?
All right. I want to talk about the Mavericks and the early sample size we have of the Kyrie and Luka Doncic experiment. Kyrie has been a Maverick for 3 games. They're 2-1. In those games, beat the Clippers without Luka, which was pretty impressive. Like, that was a close to full strength Clippers team that they beat. And then they go to Sacramento and split 2 games there. Kyrie's been really good, something like 26 points, you know, 7 assists. He's shooting 43% from 3-point range. So he's off to a good start. Luka's only played in one of those games,
I think, against the last one.
Yeah, the last game against Sacramento. Ironically, they lost. I got to tell you, Howard, I kind of expected this. Like, I expected Kyrie to play well because Kyrie's playing for a contract. And Kyrie knows that the only way he gets the deal he was looking for in Brooklyn is if he plays out of his mind, the Mavericks play above expectations, and he doesn't do things like tweet out anti-Semitic films. Like, those are the only ways that Kyrie's going to get that contract. So this is about what I expected. I mean, I'd like to see what they look like. And they play 2 good teams, 2 playoff teams. But, like, let's see what they look like against top-tier teams in the Western Conference after Luka gets back. I still don't know enough about how this tandem is going to work.
It's way too soon. It's way too soon. And, you know, the first couple of games, the first, you know, sometimes weeks of games, when you've got two stars who have never played together, especially when they are both primary ball handler types, it takes, you know, some time for them to figure it out. Usually they'll be over deferential, right? Usually it's everybody wants to show how unselfish they are and how welcoming they are and how we're going to make this work. So I'm going to be the one to keep passing. And then sometimes that goes to an extreme, right? Where nobody wants to dominate the ball too much. I thought they looked pretty good together the other night, but it's 1 game. They did lose the game in overtime, but, you know, the Kings are a good team and that was on the road. So there's no conclusion to draw yet. Other than it looks like Josh Green is now the third best Maverick. Like, we were talking about being
this. I love how I do love, and I forget if we said this last week. I apologize if I keep kind of forgetting. We did a lot of podcasts last week, but I forget, you know, I love this time of year, the week after the post trade deadline or post big trades, when it's all about, like, hey man, we held on to this guy. Remember in Minnesota, like, we held on to Jaden McDaniels. Like, we didn't deal him. That was a big win. Now it's like Josh Green is the man. And look, he played well, good player, but I'm not quite ready to jump on board the victory lap that there seems to be with Josh Green playing
He's looking really good. I mean,
he's good, but let's again, time, yeah, I know. Playoffs,
yes,
wins.
Absolutely. It's worth noting, though, not just for we were smart not to trade him to Brooklyn in the Kyrie deal. It's not even just that or justifying, drafting him ahead of, ahead of Desmond Bane and some others. And so not just that. It's more to me, it's about if the Mavericks are going anywhere, like just having Luka and Kyrie in the backcourt as maybe the best offensive backcourt in the league isn't enough. That's never enough. You need a third player to pop. You need some defense. You need other things to work in your favor. And if Josh Green is starting to become like a serious force for them, it's worth noting. That's all. It's early. We'll see. One game with the two of them is not enough to figure out, to determine how well they're fitting together, what it'll be like in crunch time, night in, night out. What the usage rates, shot selection, all that looks like. We'll see. But we already knew this. We knew that Luka was one of the best offensive forces in the game, period, as a passer and shooter and creator. And we knew that Kyrie is one of the most creative scorers we've ever seen in this league, period. It should be explosive. Whether they can play enough defense to contend is going to be the question.
Who do you think, let me ask you this question. Who do you think had or made the biggest risk at the trade deadline, Dallas or Phoenix? Because, over the weekend I was reading some local papers and I don't know if you read the column, Phil Boas of the Arizona Republic wrote that the trade involving Kevin Durant was the worst trade in Arizona sports history. I love it. I love wow. it. I love the hot take.
I did not see that, but wow.
It was a great column. It was a great column. It may have been hyperbolic, just saying, but he did cite references that Arizona sports teams have made some big time mistakes over the years. But he makes salient points that, if this doesn't go right this year and next year, you're stuck with a 36-year-old Kevin Durant, Chris Paul probably gone. Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton are still there, but you don't have any draft picks to build a team around you. Like, this is they're rolling the dice here. It's not to say I wouldn't have done it, because it was pretty clear that the team they had wasn't winning a championship. Probably wasn't even getting out of the second round. But It doesn't take away the risk that they are taking here. Because if their injuries, and these guys are injury prone, Durant, Paul, Booker, injury prone players, muscle type injury prones. If they lose one of these guys for any stretch of time at or near the playoffs, there goes this year. And then next year might be the last year you can probably pull one off with this group. I tend to agree with our Arizona Republic colleague that this is a pretty damn risky deal to make.
No, listen, in the wake of a deal, we usually, the part we overreact to is the fireworks, right? Oh my gosh, the Phoenix Suns got Kevin Durant, or, when the Nets got Durant and Kyrie, or what, any deals, the Clippers getting Kawhi and Paul George, like we get excited about a team forming a super team, or even putting two big stars together because of what does it mean for them? Can they compete? Can they contend at the highest level? And we often don't focus as much on the price of getting the guy, right? We now are already in a time where 3.5 years later, we're wondering, gee, should the Clippers really have been all in on the Kawhi Paul George thing? And would they be better off if they had kept Shai Gilgeous-Alexander? You start second guessing these things after the fact, because the risk, even though we can assess it in the moment of the trade, you don't really see the downside until things don't go the way you wanted them to, right? We're at the point now where the Clippers have gone long enough without a payoff that you start to wonder, would you have been better off just keeping Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and not making this massive swing? And the Suns right now, the first thing is, are they contenders in the West? And as you know, I'm kind of like, listen, pump the brakes a little. They are a contender in the West. I don't think they are the overwhelming favorite. We have to see a lot go right first. And there's only going to be 20 or so games with Kevin Durant in the lineup before the playoffs. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, the downside risk, is considerable. I mean, 4 first-round picks unprotected, a pick swap, sent out a couple of really good players, and, Mikal Bridges could be a future defensive player of the year. And yeah, if it all goes awry, as you point out, and it's the right thing to point out, Kevin Durant's going to be 35 later this year. He's still, and forever will be, an Achilles reconstruction patient. That has implications for his health. And Chris Paul's really freaking old. And like, we don't know what the window is for this team. It doesn't mean it's the wrong move. And I want to say this too.
No.
Like, if they don't win a championship, they go to the finals and they lose. They go to the conference finals and they lose. Whatever it may be, if you've got a chance to get one of the greatest players in history while still playing at a high level, right? I'm not saying getting, you know, end of his career Tracy McGrady or end of his career Paul Pierce. I don't mean like those. Kevin Durant is one of the, you know, whatever, 10, 15 best players in NBA history. If you can get him while he's still performing at an all NBA level and you have the players around him to make a run, then you do it. But there is a massive, massive amount of risk here based on all the components they put in this deal. And I admire it. And, you know, look, if you were, let's put it this way. If you were new Suns owner, Matt Ishbia, if you were Suns president, James Jones, would you do this deal exactly as it went down?
Yeah. And every executive that I talked to about the deal in the aftermath said they would do it or would have done it themselves. But they acknowledge the massive risk on the back end. Like, it really is like a 2-year window to win a championship with this team. If they don't, you're going to have a lot of, or at least one, if not two, if Chris Paul's still around, really aging pieces. And that's often not, as much as Kevin Durant seems to defy time when he's playing, I'm not going to bet right now that at 36 years old, he's going to be Kevin Durant. That's just a lot to bet on.
He misses a third of every season. That has been the case since he came back from the Achilles. He misses about a third of every season. So that means also, however this season goes down, maybe you win a championship this June, and at that point you just say, you know what? Doesn't even matter what happens from here. We got a championship. That's the point of the exercise. The Raptors were perfectly happy to get one championship out of Kawhi. Maybe Durant helps them win a championship in a couple months from now, and everything that comes after that doesn't matter. But if they don't win a championship this June, next season, count on Kevin Durant missing about a third of the season. Count on Chris Paul missing about a third of the season. And they make the playoffs next year. Okay, there's your next shot at maybe winning a championship. Well, if it doesn't happen by then, now you're getting to the point where it really is like not even a 2-year window. It's like a 2 postseason window this spring and next spring. And after that, you're so far on the downside with your older players that it would be really tough. I will say this is a last thought on it, though. From the moment they got Chris Paul, I always thought, what are they going to do when Chris Paul starts to fall off? Because he's such a key to their entire rebirth. The Suns were nothing until Chris Paul got there, despite Devin Booker, despite DeAndre Ayton, despite Mikal Bridges. They were going nowhere until Chris Paul arrived. He pulled this thing together and got them to the next level. When he can't play anymore, or if he erodes further, when he retires, whatever it is, I wondered what they would do. You don't just go out and find another Chris Paul to galvanize your team. But Durant helps extend that at least a little bit and take some of the pressure off Chris Paul. But it also does mean, now instead of one guy who is, you know, maybe a couple years away from retirement at any given time, now you got two.
They were undefeated in the bubble, Howard. I don't think Chris Paul had anything to do with it. Like, that team was rolling before Chris Paul got there. You know what worries me about the Suns this season is that, you know, I think they're going to rely on buyout guys. Like, they're already, you know, locked in Terrence Ross. He's going to head there. Ross is a good player, but I think they'll probably get somebody else in the next couple of days. And anytime you kind of have to rely on guys that get cut loose, it generally doesn't work. So there's just too many moving parts for me to bet that Phoenix is the front runner, at least in the Western Conference this year. All right. I want to talk a little bit about Brooklyn. And I watched the game they played against the 76ers the other night. And that was kind of what I'm expecting from Brooklyn for the rest of this season, where they can play, like, they've got good defenders, they can play great on both ends, but when it comes time to get a bucket, they don't got that guy anymore. Like, they got stifled in the last 6 minutes of that 76ers game, and, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie did make a big shot, or almost made a big shot to send the game to overtime, but they just didn't have anyone they could turn to be a reliable scorer. That's kind of going to be, I think, what they are the rest of the year. They can still hold on to a playoff spot. I think that's still definitely possible because they can defend. And they are going to play with a lot of energy. But I think in close games, they're going to have a lot of problems because they don't have that guy. And I don't think of this group anyone's going to ultimately emerge. Now, I am curious to get your take on, like, there's a lot of palace intrigue with you know, what the Nets were. You had Kyrie talking about stuff going on behind the scenes when he went to Dallas, saying he was glad that Kevin Durant got out of there, you know, kind of bad-mouthing the Brooklyn situation on the way out the door. James Harden, in his first appearance in Brooklyn, alluded to a level of dysfunction, said there was a lot of dysfunction in Brooklyn. He said there were a lot of, quote, internal things that I'm not going to ever just say, put in the media or anything, and that was one of the reasons why I chose to make my decision to leave, end quote. So, are we ever thinking going to find out, like, what was going on behind the scenes in Brooklyn? Like, on the surface, it looked like Sean Marks put together a pretty talented team. Like, he got Kevin Durant. He got James Harden. He got Kyrie Irving. You can say he gave up too much for James Harden. Yeah, fine. You could say he should have gone out and gotten James Harden in the first place. They'd be better off with Jared Allen and the other piece they had to let go to get James Harden. But I don't know, man. Like, maybe we'll learn in a book like 5-10 years later. Maybe there'll be a great TikTok piece written, you know, next year. But I'm fascinated to know what the hell was going on behind the scenes that bothered Kyrie Irving and bothered James Harden so much. Like, to me, it looked like Kyrie didn't get what he wanted contractually, so he asked out. And we know that we believe that to be true in part because a week before he asked for a trade, his agent slash stepmother went to Chris Haynes and said, we want to be in Brooklyn long term. Like, it's the ball's in the Nets court. So he didn't get what he wanted and he asked out. And Harden, to my eyes, seemingly just got annoyed with Kyrie Irving. Like, he just, you know, he was part of that team last year when Kyrie was in and out of the lineup, and Harden just decided, you know what, screw it. I don't want to do this anymore. So I don't know, man. Like, I'm not going to sit here and blindly defend ownership, Sean Marks, that front office, because I do think they made some mistakes. I said from jump, Steve Nash was not the right guy. I was anti-Nash all the way throughout. I thought they were trying to be too cute and too smart when they hired Steve Nash. They should have either stuck with Jacque Vaughn or gone with somebody else with more experience. But if that's the only mistake they made, I don't get it. Responsibility at some point has to fall on the players, doesn't it? Like, I'm very curious to see what Kevin Durant says when he's finally introduced in Phoenix, if he has anything to say about the behind-the-scenes stuff that apparently was going on in Brooklyn.
KD's not real big on airing things out. He doesn't have that same level of just, like, jaundiced whatever that like Kyrie does. Like, Kyrie wants to kill the Nets. That's clear. I'm not sure that Kevin Durant cares one way or the other about that stuff. KD never seemed all that. I know he asked for the trade last summer and all that stuff, but there were a lot of things I think that were going into that weren't about, like, oh, the Nets are off the rails. And again, I've made the point 100 times and I'll make it again. If Kevin Durant really thought that Sean Marks and Steve Nash were that bad, he could have asked for them to be fired back in April, May, or June, July. And he didn't do that until August because he was using that as his last get out of jail free card to try to force the trade. And they still called his bluff on that, and he still came back. Steve Nash eventually was fired, but that was because of results, not because of anything else. Sean Marks has made certainly plenty of mistakes. Joe Tsai, the owner, has made plenty of mistakes. A lot of those mistakes, if we're going to like catalog them, had to do with deferring too much to the stars. So if James Harden or Kyrie or even KD want to say there was a problem with the way things were run, it's because they were catering too much to those guys and gave up the culture that had been so great, so valued, that the entire league was praising the Nets for how great a culture they'd built the first few years under Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson from 2016 to 2019, all of which went out the door when they signed Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and their buddy DeAndre Jordan, who was foisted on them by Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. So those are the kind, like, if you want to criticize management and ownership, it was doing things like signing DeAndre Jordan to a ridiculous contract and then being forced to start him ahead of Jared Allen because it's what your stars wanted and allowing the stars to dictate. Kevin Durant certainly had a voice in hiring Steve Nash. Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving certainly had a voice in the firing of Steve Nash. Kyrie Irving was the one who said, we don't even need a coach. We're all coaches. Then Kyrie Irving said, we're a management team. And when they were eliminated from the playoffs last year by the Celtics after they were swept, and Kyrie sat up there saying, well, you know, me and Sean and Joe and KD, we're going to straighten this thing out, as if he's part of management. Like, Kyrie has no credibility. Can we just, like, we should just start there. Yes, Kyrie is casting aspersions now that he's safely in Dallas, but Kyrie has no credibility. One, because he is the source of about 75-80% of the angst around this team the last couple of years. All the dysfunction, him not being available, had a massive influence on James Harden wanting out. So when Harden is alluding to stuff without naming names or saying specifics, a lot of that is Kyrie Irving, because the Nets didn't handle that well either. Again, it's Kyrie's fault he wasn't eligible, but the Nets said, well, we're not going to play him at all. Then when they got desperate, they're like, I guess we're going to play him for road games at least. So they were inconsistent. They were all over the map. They were even inconsistent in the way that they handled Kyrie's posting of the anti-Semitic film. First, they didn't do anything. They didn't even want to name him in a press release when they tried to distance themselves from what he had done. Like, they have been all over the map. So I'm not going to absolve the Nets management of anything. But when it comes to the Nets' failures over the last few years, and the reason that all these stars are somewhere else, it's mostly because of the stars. And Kyrie more than any of them. And the thing that I think is the most ludicrous of all the things that Kyrie has done or said in the wake of this is, I wanted out after year one. Well, you tried to get an extension that they wouldn't give you. So you clearly were willing to sign on for more years. And that was last summer. And then you could have opted out and gone free agency, but you didn't. You opted in and stayed. And then your agent was trying to get an extension, which, as you point out, Chris, she went public and said, we want this extension, and the ball's in the Nets court. So if you'd gotten the extension, you'd still be in Brooklyn. How could you then say, I want it out after year one, and I'm glad KD got out, and there's such a mess? You kept trying to stay. You kept saying publicly you wanted to stay. It's so disingenuous to, the second he's traded, then turn around and make it sound as if like the Nets are at fault for everything, when he was clearly trying to get an extension, trying to stay, doing everything possible to get that extension. You could even hear it in some of the stuff he said. He goes, I did what I was supposed to do. KD was out and they're still in fourth place because of me. Well, they were like 4-7 or whatever the record was. I don't have it in front of me. While KD was out and Kyrie was leading them. They didn't exactly blow the league away with just Kyrie leading them. He did play very well during that stretch. And it's clear by the way he said that he was hoping the reward for keeping them afloat was and playing well and being quiet and not saying anything else outrageous or making any problems. He thought the reward would be, I'm going to get that extension that they didn't want to give me last year because they said I was too much of a destabilizing element or whatever they would have said. He thought, I've behaved myself. I've been a good citizen. I've played well. I should get that max extension. And when the Nets balked, that's when he's offended. And when he starts saying things like the disrespect and this and that, that's what he means. He means they weren't giving him a max deal. Well, guess what, Kyrie Irving? No one in the NBA wants to give you a max deal for max years and max money. No one. And he'll find that out again this summer.
Yep. And as far as the Nets go, you know, keeping Mikal Bridges is a good move. He is a tremendous young player who has a chance to be an all-star in the next couple of years because of the role he's going to get with the Nets. But if they turn around and decide to trade him this summer, you know, it's pretty clear you can get 3 first-round picks back in exchange for him. And that's more draft capital for Sean Marks to build the team in a more organic way. So we'll see.
Yeah, look. Let me do a couple of quick hit observations on the Nets right now, just before we leave this topic. They've already been comparing this team to like the pre Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving version, right? When they had Spencer Dinwiddie the first time and Joe Harris and Jared Allen and Caris LeVert and all these guys. This is actually a much better version of what they had from 16 through 19, right? Like, this is the top level talent, it's higher. It's just simply higher. Also, they have a ton of picks. Like, yes, their own picks are out the door to Houston, but you look at, they've got the 4 picks from the Suns coming, plus a swap, plus a Dallas first rounder, plus 2 Philly first rounders. So that's, what, 7 extra picks? And while the Rockets do, quote unquote, control the Nets drafts for the next several years, some of those are swaps, which may or may not happen. And then the Suns still have picks to use those years. Even if there is a swap, then they've simply got the Rockets pick instead of their own. They have a ton of draft capital, and Bridges, Cam Johnson, Dorian Finney-Smith, Royce O'Neal, Spencer Dinwiddie, Joe Harris, Seth Curry, the ghost of Ben Simmons, Nick Claxton, Yuta Watanabe. Like, they just have a lot of really good, useful players, including a ton of those guys I just named are good 3-and-D guys, good perimeter defenders. They are arguably in the driver's seat, or among the handful of teams that if the next disgruntled superstar becomes available tomorrow, the Nets have the combination of picks and players to do it and still have a good supporting cast in place for that player to play with. So they're actually in very good shape, and in better shape than they were when Marks first arrived in 2016. So very curious to see where it goes. Very curious to see in the offseason what kind of moves they might be making with some of those players and picks. And in the meantime, as you said, they're going to be good. They're going to be competitive. They'll lose close games because they don't have a guy to create in a tight game. Spencer Dinwiddie almost got that shut off in time. And he can do some things, and we've seen him with as a good clutch player before, his previous time in Brooklyn for one. But they're going to be interesting. And they're well positioned to recover quickly this time.
They just hired Kenny Atkinson and just pretend the last 6 years didn't happen. Be like, you know, Kenny, we got another young team here, needs developing. Close your eyes and let's take out one of those Men in Black, or open your eyes, take out one of those Men in Black things and zap it. Pretend the last 6 years. You've been the coach this entire time, Kenny, and now you're making more money. We'll give you more money as an apology. We'll see where the Nets go. Real quick, I want to ask you about the Lakers, because I felt like I was alone on an island for a while, Howard, thinking the Lakers had a good trade deadline. Like, I wrote it on SI.com. I talked about it here on this podcast and on the two podcasts we did last week. I just was a believer that they got the right pieces around them. And look, as we record this, they've only won one game in a row. That was a decent road win in Golden State. But they play in Portland on Monday night. See what happens there. The Blazers are mediocre team, but they're one of those mediocre teams right in front of them in the standings. So that's a winnable game. Then LeBron is scheduled to come back on Wednesday against the zombie, Pelicans. Then you get the All-Star break, which presumably will give LeBron, AD, some of the guys there time to heal their various injuries. You go into the unofficial second half of the season, which is really like 25, 30 games. But you go into the second half of the season with healthy LeBron, healthy AD, bunch of shooters. Like, I'm telling you, like, if let's say they win the next two games and they're going into the All-Star break with a three-game winning streak hovering around like the 10 seed, right in that range, which is possible. They're going to make the playoffs. They will. If they're healthy in the second half of the season, they are going to make the playoffs. And you'll never convince me that, Memphis, Denver, any of the top tier teams that are going to finish 1 through 4 want any part of them. Like, that'll be the team they want the least if they get in the first round. There could be some good teams in the bottom half of the playoff bracket, including the Clippers. But the Lakers, if they're healthy with those shooters, I mean, look at that Golden State game. Like, you saw D'Angelo Russell play well. He clearly is a much better fit with this Laker team than Russell Westbrook was. You got Jared Vanderbilt coming off the bench, doing Jared Vanderbilt things, high energy, rebounding, second chance opportunities. Like, he was everywhere on that floor. Like, that was a good trade for the Lakers. We cannot let, what is that phrase? Don't let perfect be an obstacle.
Enemy of the good.
Enemy of the good, something like whatever that is. I'm blanking. Like that. But that's the situation. Like, they didn't get the superstar. They didn't get Bradley Beal. But you know what? They're pretty good. And now they've got like an 8-deep, 9-deep rotation when LeBron gets back with guys that seemingly fit around them. That team's going to be a problem. They're going to be a problem. Like, anyone predict they're not going to make the playoffs? If they're healthy, you're dead wrong. And you get into the playoffs with that team, anything can happen, including winning the Western Conference. Anything can happen with that team.
Listen, I wouldn't predict them winning the West. I wouldn't predict a deep playoff run. But they are, I think, indisputably, demonstrably, objectively in a better position to make a playoff run now than they were before the trade deadline. I, as you know, have been as critical of Rob Pelinka as anybody, and was critical of the Lakers for sitting on those picks as long as they did. I think there were deals they could have made sooner, right? Like, they should have moved off Westbrook last summer. Like, they finally cut the cord, and now they're of course, employing the usual whisper campaign of there were all these problems and things were even worse than anybody believed. That's probably true, but if it is true, well, that's on you then for not resolving the situation sooner. Maybe it's on Westbrook also for whatever was going on in the locker room and with his the way he comported himself on the court. That's all fair. And I'm certainly not about to start defending Westbrook in the way he played in LA or the way he fit or did not fit. But everybody could see that this was not working before. So I'm still going to say, Lakers, you should have moved a pick or two or whatever it took to offload Westbrook last summer. And if you could have gotten the Pacer package of Hield and Turner then you should have done it then. But I'm not going to say that Rob Pelinka and the Laker front office are vindicated by the trade deadline, but they atoned fairly well at the trade deadline by getting the players they did. D'Angelo Russell and Vanderbilt and Beasley, even Mo Bamba, like, you upgraded your rotation. Every single one of those guys can play minutes immediately, and in some of those cases, start ahead of guys who were starting before who should not have been NBA starters. Like, we did the exercise earlier this season. The problem with the Lakers was, outside of LeBron and Anthony Davis, they would start three guys every night who maybe one of them would be a starter somewhere else. Two would be deep bench guys. And on some teams, none of their other three starters would have started for any other decent team in the NBA, a team with playoff hopes. So they took guys who should not have been starters and replaced them with actual starting caliber players. And as a domino effect, now have guys coming off the bench who are better as sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth men, as opposed to being the third, fourth, fifth men or whatever they were, or fifth, sixth. So they have upgraded. Again, scant time left to get everybody kind of in sync with each other. D'Angelo Russell, not a big fan, but he's talented and he can score and he's having a really efficient season. I think he'll be great playing off LeBron. But, you know, I think the biggest concern right now is that LeBron's missed the last couple games since he got the record with an ongoing foot injury that is now being said to be something that might bother him the rest of the season.
I know he's going to, but I hope he doesn't play the All-Star game.
Like, no, I was going to say, I think we're going to get one of those like 5-minute cameos, right? Like, he's going to start the game. He's going to play a little bit. They're going to honor him again. They're going to do a ceremony about the record, I believe, during All-Star weekend. But yeah, LeBron needs to just take most of the weekend off, and I'm sure he will. But that's got to be their biggest concern now. But I'm with you, Chris. LeBron James healthy, Anthony Davis healthy, and those are big ifs for both of them. Plus this roster, if they had had this roster from day one, they wouldn't be in the situation they're in now. They would be much more solidly in the mix in the playoff field. We wouldn't be talking about, are they going to be able to make the play-in and then make the playoffs? Like, this is a significantly better group that, frankly, they should have had from day one.
They play Wednesday this week, and then they're not back in a game until next Thursday. That is a full 8 days to heal. And as you said, LeBron, whether he plays in the game or not, he's going to take it easy. And nobody knows how to take care of their body better than LeBron James. So he'll spend All-Star weekend doing the things he needs to do to get that foot as healthy as it can be. They're going to be a problem. I'm telling you, a big, 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 big problem if LeBron and AD can stay on the floor the second half of the season. They're going to make the playoffs. Look at the teams above them. Portland's above them. That's not going anywhere. Utah just, you know, dismantled what was left of its team. Oklahoma City is like soft tanking right now. You trade away Mike Muscala, and with apologies to some of my good friends in Oklahoma City, you know, that's, you're trading away a guy that was playing a little bit. So that's I don't think they want to make the playoffs. I guess I'll put it that way. They don't want to be in the postseason. And then you look above them and it's like Golden State's there. Minnesota's there. The Pelicans are in a free fall right now. Like, I'm comfortable saying this Lakers team is going to make the playoffs, or at the very least be in the play-in and should make the playoffs. And if they do, I don't know who, like, I look at the top, like Denver, Memphis, Sacramento, Dallas. That's your top four right now, Howard. Are you picking all four of those teams to beat the Lakers? Like, the Nuggets, you probably would, because the Nuggets have been, you know, the best team in the Western Conference for a while. But Memphis is weird. You know, they go and get Luke Kennard. We'll see what happens if he addresses their three-point shooting issues or if his defensive deficiencies keep him off the floor. Sacramento, great story, but, you know, I'm not picking Fox and Sabonis against LeBron and AD, that's for sure. And then Dallas, we just talked about, like, vulnerable in a lot of different ways. Like, that's, the field is open, baby. It's wide open, Howard. The bottom four might actually try to be better than the top four. If, like, Phoenix is in there, the Clippers, the Lakers, like, can you imagine that?
Well, I expect Phoenix will be in the top four by the time all is said and done. Like, they probably displace the Mavericks, don't they?
Probably.
And I haven't looked at strength of schedule for the rest of the season or anything else, but if Durant gets
Lakers, by the way, strength of schedule is bottom third. It's like 24th right now. And that may change because I think they've got a couple of games with the Suns and those games become exponentially tougher. Maybe we'll finally get a KD versus LeBron game. It's been like, I think, 6 years since one of them. But
so if, if the Suns do get KD shortly after All-Star, right? And if the fit is as seamless as we expect it should be, and if their depth issues aren't too bad, they get guys off the buyout market, the Suns should be top four. That pushes Dallas to five. Clippers are now sixth. Like, that group is probably the group. That is probably the top six, right? Denver, Memphis, Sac, Dallas, Phoenix, Clippers. That six, in some order, is probably not changing. Zion, we just heard from David Griffin, Pelicans president. Zion's out for at least a few more weeks beyond the All-Star break, so that's bad. So I don't, you know, I thought there was going to be a Pelicans second half revival, and I'm pretty skeptical of that right now. The Timberwolves, I don't trust at all. The Warriors, we'll see. I'll never rule them out. But you're right. Then we're to 10th. That's the Thunder. Are the Lakers right now just have to pass the Blazers, Jazz, and Thunder, and now that puts them in the play-in. That's should be automatic. And then it's like, okay, do they come out of the play-in? Now you're a 7th or 8th seed, and your first round matchup is either, as at the moment, Denver or Memphis. Maybe by all is said and done, maybe it's Denver and Phoenix at the top. The favorites will be the favorites for a reason. The Lakers will be big underdogs. But if LeBron and Anthony Davis are healthy with competent supporting cast around them, and now they have some competence around them, I don't think those teams want to face him. I really don't. And, you know, if they were fortunate enough to somehow draw, you know, a Dallas or something in the first round, I'd put my money on the Lakers. But that's not going to happen because the Lakers are probably 7th or 8th, and Dallas is not going to be 1st or 2nd.
No, they're not. But it could make for a wild Western Conference playoff bracket, you know, how it all ultimately shakes out. Last thing for you, Howard. Dust is settled. We know what these teams are. Most of the bio guys are earmarked for whatever teams are going to go to. Danny Green to Cleveland. We mentioned Terrence Ross. He's going to go to Phoenix. Maverick's going to get a guy or two. Right now, who's your favorite? Not just to win the Western Conference, but the whole thing.
I don't think it's changed. I think before the trade deadline, if you'd asked me who are the favorites to win the championship, I'd say it's Celtics or Bucks are the two teams I would go with, obviously both out of the East. And I think it's still Celtics and Bucks. I think there's another tier right after them that includes the Suns with Durant there, that includes the Sixers who have been surging, and that includes the Nuggets. So I think Celtics and Bucks are the top tier of that. Those are the favorites. The next tier is the Sixers, so one more Eastern Conference team, and then the Suns and Nuggets are somewhere in there. And then I've got I created another tier of like lurking. So like lurking in the West. The Clippers, Warriors, and Grizzlies are kind of like my lurking. Like if things broke right for them and broke badly for the teams that I named ahead of them, Clippers, Warriors, Grizzlies, you keep an eye on. And then lurking in the East, the Cavs, but it's harder because breaking through the Celtics and Bucks will be harder for the Cavs than I think maybe one of the lower teams breaking through in the West.
Yeah, I'm with you on the top two. I lean a little bit towards Boston. They've been the most complete team all season long. I'll tell you this, though. The Celtics are very nervous about Milwaukee. Milwaukee is the team that makes Boston anxious. The Celtics got Mike Muscala. They really wanted Jakob Poeltl. I did some digging on that over the last couple of days. They talked to San Antonio about Poeltl, and they were willing to give up a first-round pick to get him, but the Spurs kind of made the calculation that Toronto's first-round pick is going to be better than Boston's first-round pick, and the Celtics just weren't willing to throw two firsts in there to get Poeltl. And look, I kind of thought he might just be a rental, but I'm starting to believe that, you know, they would have been able to sign Jakob Poeltl. Like, I think they were on kind of the same page with what Jakob Poeltl wanted in terms of his wants and what the Celtics were willing to pay. And Jakob Poeltl, even though he's been a starter, you know, in San Antonio, and he'll get the chance to start in Toronto, I think he just wants to be paid as a starter. So, you know, the Celtics, I think, would feel much better about their chances of beating Milwaukee if they had Jakob Poeltl, because that front line of the Bucks, you know, you're kind of like one Rob Williams injury away from being in real big trouble. And Rob Williams has had knee issues. Al Horford's 36. Like, I just think they're a little leery about how much they may have to use Luke Kornet and now Mike Muscala on that front line. But even with that, those potential issues, if they go into that series healthy, I think the Celtics are a favorite, even if Chris Middleton is playing. So I go Celtics 1, Bucks 1A or 2, and then to me, everybody else is the next tier. You know, it's however you want to frame it. Phoenix, Denver, Sixers, any of those teams in that mix. There's a pretty clear, in my mind, gap right now between Celtics and Bucks and everybody else.
I agree. And frankly, I agree with you on the Celtics being the favorite over the Bucks too. Like if that 7-game series started tomorrow, I would certainly pick the Celtics. Not just because of home court, but I just think they've got better depth. They're just sounder all around. They've got more ways they can go, more ways they can beat you right now. The Bucks, you know, the respect for them as a defending champ, or, you know, not long since their championship, veteran cast, guys who, you know, you know what you're going to get from them. I just think the Celtics have a little bit more firepower.
Yeah. Well, that conference final should be pretty good if that's the way it ultimately shakes out. Howard, good stuff, man. We will do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.